You're listening to the Fifth Estate podcast. In this episode, recorded on Tuesday the 30th of July 2019, we're joined by Lowy Institute Executive Director Michael Fullilove for a conversation about the state of Australia's foreign affairs. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft.
Michael Fullilove, of course, is the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute for International Policy. He writes and talks here in Australia and abroad and for publications, including New York Times, Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs. He pops up pretty much everywhere. He is an award-winning author of numerous books, including Rendezvous with Destiny and Men and Women of Australia, Our Greatest Modern Speeches. He worked previously as a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and as an advisor to Paul Keating. He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University, and in 2015 he delivered the Marvellous Boyer Lectures. So please, another welcome for Michael Fullilove.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me.
It's so great to have you back here. Yes. There's not that many people we invite back, but it's been 3.5 years. I couldn't believe it when I realised how long since you were last here. And at that time, it was March 2016, and Donald Trump was looking like the likely nominee for the Republican Party. And
you're not going to quote back to me what I said about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I am. When I asked you about Trump running in March 2016, you said, "One has to hope and have trust in the rationality of American voters." It's funny, isn't it, how we laugh? Let's get all the laughter out because it's about to get incredibly grim, right? You described him as a vulgar individual, which I love because I usually refer to him as the vulgarian, but because you're here tonight, I'm going to refer to him as the president. The truth is, this is another quote, the truth is that Donald Trump is an isolationist. It's not completely incoherent. It's terrifying. So, and I should add that you also expressed a possibility that he could win. You didn't put any money on it. We still talked more about Hillary Clinton and that likelihood, but you certainly didn't. You weren't laughing.
Either horse can win in a two-horse race.
That's right. And I want to focus a bit on that word. It's terrifying. Mm-hmm. About how you're feeling now, 2.5, nearly years into his presidency, because I've felt, and particularly in the last couple of weeks, particularly since what happened with the four congresswomen, I'm back to a sense of having trouble sleeping again, and a sense that the normalisation of his racism and of his behaviour, it does actually terrify me. So how are you feeling about it now that he's here and settled in?
Well, I guess I would separate how he conducts himself in his domestic politics with the effect that he has on the world, and I'm happy to talk about both of those. I mean, in terms of the effect on the world, I think when he came to power, when I said it's not incoherent, the reason I said that was a lot of people assumed he just knew nothing and he was dumb and all that, and that's not the case. Actually, he had a very structured, coherent worldview. He scoffed at the idea of American leadership and cooperation in the world. He was a skeptic of free trade. He was an unbeliever in alliances, and he had a weird affinity for strong men. And those four principles of his worldview have continued in office, and I think They describe many of the policies that he's tried to put in place. A reason for hope and optimism is that a lot of the sharp edges of that policy have been worn off by the deep state, and thank God for the deep state, who have pushed back on alliances and on trade and on democracy and on strongmen, and have limited the effect that he's had to some extent. A fifth element that has always been there in his mindset is that he has always been, he has never sort of really bought into the idea of the use of American force. And this is an important thing, that by this stage in the Bush presidency, we were heading headlong into the Iraq War. And that's not the case under President Trump. In fact, he is highly skeptical about the use of force. So when you think about the impact he's had on the world, he has moved America away from its moorings as an internationalist country, a free trading country, an alliance, a leader of alliances. But he hasn't taken America into a great conflict that has had all sorts of ramifications, as for example, the Iraq War did.
I mean, according to him, I think, you know, recently he was about 10 minutes away from that possibility. But is it also true that he hasn't yet, and hopefully, you know, won't be, but been tested to do that, so that we don't necessarily know what his response might be?
Well, first of all, he was 10 minutes away from a limited airstrike against Iranian assets, which is quite different, obviously, from launching a ground war and invading and occupying an Arab country, which is what the George W. Bush administration did. So I just mention it not to defend President Trump, but there's a lot of Bushies who are now occupying the high moral ground when it came to President Trump. And I think historians will have an interesting argument as to who had a more deleterious effect on the world, actually, George W. Bush or Donald Trump. Of course, as you say, we're only halfway through Donald Trump's first term, and I think it's true that, to some extent, he's been lucky. He hasn't been tested yet, and so his full instincts haven't come out yet, and that does disturb me, because he hasn't changed his mind on any of those things. We know, because we read it live in his tweets. He still has a crush on Vladimir Putin. He, you know, he has a bit of a bromance with Kim Jong-un. He likes strong men. He likes tough guys who get the mail through. He doesn't like Democrats and people, you know, people who are raising human rights and those sorts of questions. So his instincts are there, and no doubt they will come out, and no doubt he will be tested more than he has been.
Bob Carr was a guest here in November, just before the midterms, and he put the suggestion out that we need to actually question to what degree America can still call itself truly a liberal democracy. And I wonder what your response is to that.
I think America is a resilient democracy, and you've seen institutions, it depends how you define liberal democracy, but most of the institutions within the United States have been remarkably resilient. The courts, the institutions of law enforcement, one exception has been the Republican Party, the grand old party of Lincoln, of Eisenhower, of Reagan. The Republican Party has more or less rolled over and has become a creature of Donald Trump. And as someone with lots of Republican friends, that's something that I find very disturbing. But I wouldn't agree that we can question whether the United States is any longer a liberal democracy. I think democracy in the United States will survive Donald Trump. He's a big character, but he's not that big. American democracy has been around for a long time. There's an election just around the corner, you know. So let's not get ahead of ourselves on that issue, I think.
If you believe, as I unquestionably do, that he is an outright racist, I wonder, you know, how does that fit with the idea of the Western liberal democracy and certainly Australia's most important ally, that it's now being ruled by somebody... I think it's inarguable that he is racist and he's using it, and it will increase as we get into next year and an election year.
So what's the question exactly? How should we react to it?
I'll get to that, how we might react to it. But the of what it means for America and its tradition of liberal democracy that... I fear that the normalisation of it is disturbing me so much, so increasingly. I think to myself, if you were a 10-year-old kid 2.5 years ago, and Barack Obama was, if you're a black or coloured American, and you were say 10 years old when Barack Obama was outgoing, and now you are 12, 13 years old, and this is what your president is saying. There was a fantastic cartoon in the New Yorker, I think, last week, with a mother scolding her child, saying, "You will not use presidential language in this house." How do you explain that to your children? I don't know. Or for somebody like I'm Jewish. I changed that and imagine as a Jew, if these were Jews that he was talking about. I mean, I don't need to. It's the same. But how we can believe enough in these structures to be able to deal with this.
It's very confronting, and I think in a way the worst, the low point on in terms of racial politics in the Trump administration is not now, but the Charlottesville sort of catastrophe, which was, you know, where he was basically equating on the one hand neo-Nazis and anti-fascists. And as someone who wrote a book, as you kindly mentioned, on Roosevelt, that was particularly striking because it was in Charlottesville that Roosevelt gave a very famous speech before America entered the war about confronting the Nazis and confronting the fascists and how liberal democracies have to stand up for our values. So I don't want to underestimate it in any way, but I just say don't forget that, every day we're reading great newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post that are full of people who are outraged, who are full of people who are pushing back against that, who are identifying it, who are calling it out, who are struggling to prevent it from being normalised. Don't forget that there have been lots of moments in American history where a government, an administration has been wrong-headed, it has been motivated by malice or by negative values, and there's a great tradition of opposition, of principled opposition.
Never like this, though, would you agree?
Well, I don't know if that's true. I mean, is it worse now than in the civil rights days?
Was it that blatant from an American president?
He does things in an extreme way, and you know, it has implications for all of us because at a global level too, if the leader of the free world doesn't, you know, is prepared to play politics with race, if the leader of the free world has a stronger attraction, it seems, for authoritarian leaders than for democratic leaders, then to some extent, you know, we are all wrapped up in one enterprise, and the America is at the heart of it. You know, we can't get away from that. We're a part of the West, and it's Western values, not just American values that he's talking down. And I think it's very confronting for all of us.
The response to his attacks on the Congresswomen, Angela Merkel, Justin Trudeau, Jacinda Ardern and others came out and were very clear about condemning what he'd said. As usual, nothing from Australia. Absolute kowtowing silence. At what point does Australia actually have a part to play, I mean, in responding to this kind of thing? It seems to me that we are the most kowtowing of all of similar Western democracies.
Well, I thought this was going to be a nice, pleasant trip to Melbourne. There was going to be a bowl of pasta. There was going to be a glass of wine.
I'm enjoying it very much. The great thing is the clock's not even on here, so we've still got an hour to go.
Look, I think that every leader has to balance two factors. On the one hand, Mr. Trump is a very unpleasant person. On the other hand, he's the most powerful person in the world. And how do you balance these two issues? How do you progress the interests of your country and at the same time live out the values that you hold dear? And I think that, and you see leaders going both ways. You see Theresa May, for example, who was really quite sycophantic. In fact, I think that she definitely beat us on that front. I mean, if you recall the holding hands, all that sort of stuff, which Mr. Trump repaid with gross discourtesy upon discourtesy. So leaders try that and it doesn't work. And leaders try the other thing. They try the other way. They try to be standoffish, like Chancellor Merkel, as you say, who's regularly critiquing Donald Trump and who keeps her distance from him. And he finds ways to exact cost from her too. So I think all leaders are struggling with it. I think leaders are in a different position from you and me. They can't be. They're not as free as we are as commentators and as writers. They have the economic, the security interests of their country that they need to factor in. But at the same time, I think leaders need to remember that this too will pass. Donald Trump will pass, and they will have to consider, how did I conduct myself in the Trump era, and did I behave in a way that is consonant with my values or not? And I think you have to always do that if you're in public life.
I understand that, and I understand that the lines of communication have to always be open, clearly, and that there are diplomatic protocols and so on. But I want to push back on this, because I feel like, first of all, silence and then an invitation to a state dinner, followed up immediately with an invitation to come to Melbourne and play golf in December, that this kind of bonhomie, this kind of... that to say nothing... To say absolutely nothing. What would be the expectation, you know, from DFAT? From what would, I mean, are they just all wringing their hands, not knowing what to advise? Is it our Prime Minister's own choice to go that way? I mean, I want my Prime Minister to say something when the American President is behaving in a dangerously racist way. Something.
All right, but let me come back at you. Why? I mean, all this conversation has been about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Right. But is Donald Trump the worst leader in the world? I mean, how would we compare him, for example, to Xi Jinping, who runs a Leninist political party at the apex of an authoritarian state that is rapidly strengthening its control of Chinese society, that has up to a million Uyghurs in detention camps, for example?
I would say if we compare our relationship to China, it's a much more cautious one. And it's actually one where, from Australia's end, we're more open about our concerns. We're more courageous about expressing our uncertainties and our concerns.
I'm not sure about that. And look, I mean, it's a matter of judgment and it's a matter of taste, the extent to which a leader puts her or his fingers in the domestic politics of other leaders. And it's a very complicated thing to balance. But ultimately, a leader's first responsibility is to promote and protect the interests of the country that she or he governs. And there are so many equities that we have in the United States relationship from a defence point of view, an economic point of view. And also, I'd say to you also that, and I think this is an important point, that leaders have to make a judgment about what is going to have a positive effect. I mean, if Scott Morrison were to come out and say, Donald Trump is the worst person in the world, and I can completely condemn his racism, do we think that that would change Donald Trump's Twitter feed? Do we think that it would change anything? But it would do enormous damage to our own equity. So these are the things to balance. I'm not saying we should never speak up in relation to human rights. We should never criticise other leaders. But it's a very complicated path to walk.
Do you think that from Australia's foreign policy perspective, that our degree of kowtowing, and I think this is an Australian trait, I think this is very much part of our character, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, that we do this more than other similar nations. Do we gain more from it?
Well, do you mean in relation to what issue?
I mean,
to the United States.
I mean, I'm obviously focusing on Trump, and we will move on from him at some point soon. But it is our most important relationship still, and it's the most. I think it's the most complicated. Well, there are others, but at the moment, it's certainly the most confronting for our most important ally for this to be going on. So, yeah, in relation to America, that do we get some payback for our absolutely uncritical, from a prime ministerial successive too, it's not just Scott Morrison, historical sucking up?
Well, I don't recognise... I don't think those terms accord with my view of how Australia deals with the United States. Sucking up and kowtowing, I think, is too brutal.
Right.
It's not nuanced enough. It doesn't account for changes in government in Australia, changes in administration over there. I think you have to separate, for example, participation in conflicts. I think that's one point, but that's not really what you're talking about. You're talking about the way that Australian leaders conduct themselves with American presidents,
I think.
And I think there have been all sorts of different relationships there. I mean, Whitlam was on Nixon's enemies list. The relationship that somebody like, Hawke had complicated relationships with Reagan. So I think we have to agree to disagree. I think... What do we get out of the relationship? I think it's important to put that on the record. I think, first of all, I would say that, in my opinion, taking the long run, the United States plays a benign role in the world. It is the centre of the liberal international order, the fruits of which we have enjoyed for three quarters of a century. I think the role of the United States prevents other much less attractive countries from doing bad things to their neighbours, among other things, because they don't know how the United States will react. I think the presence of the United States in our region, in Asia, complicates the region, makes it much harder for Asia to be dominated by one large state in China. So what do we get out of the United States? My own view is the United States, over the long run, plays a positive role in the world, and our relationship with the United States is in our interests and it's in the world's interests. That doesn't mean that I think we should agree with everything that every president says, that we shouldn't speak up if the president does something that offends our values. It doesn't mean that I think we should go along with every US policy decision. For example, if Donald Trump were to if America were to fall into a war with Iran, and by the way, I don't think Donald Trump wants to do that, and I think the fact that he stepped back from that airstrike shows that. But if we were to do that, and if Australia were to be asked to participate, my own view would be we should say no, because our hands are full, we've got bigger fish to fry, there's so many things happening in our part of the world, we need to focus on that part of the world. So I'm not a sort of an uncritical alliance groupie. But if you ask me, do I think the United States plays a benign or a malign role in the world, I would say benign. And I don't think the role of the Australian Prime Minister is to be, he or she is not the critic in chief. Their role is to manage our interests and promote our interests in a very complicated world. And often that means dealing with unsavoury figures, including figures who are much more unpleasant than Donald Trump.
All right. Well, we will have to move on. I so want to keep asking.
We can go a bit further on Trump.
Well, you don't even have to answer, but my question to myself is, at what point does it become a sort of appeasement of a president persecuting a group of his own people that then reflects back on our values? At what point in the way that he's treating people?
I'll answer that question. I don't think, I mean, when you say appeasing his treatment of his citizens, you mean the tweets and the things he said about four Congress people? Well, I don't think that clears the bar in any sense. I mean, there are huge human rights abuses happening all around the world in all sorts of countries, and that doesn't mean we walk away from our relationships with those countries. He is playing politics in an extremely rough way, and it's a dangerous thing to do. And as someone who spent a lot of my life studying America and lived in America on a number of occasions, I don't like the look of it. But there are a lot worse things happening in the world than that.
All right. We'll move on to Boris now. much more fun. very, very interesting. To begin with, he was a guest at Lowy, gave a fantastic speech as Foreign Minister, the 2017 Lowy Lecture, and where he described himself, I think, as an unconscious Les Paterson and had a dig at Lowy for serving wine from Glasgow, which you should have a look at it.
He said so many funny things, it's hard to remember.
Yeah, it's on the Lowy website, and it's really worth a look.
He's been a guest twice, actually. He spoke to a small event we held a few years earlier, I think 2012, when he was Mayor of London.
Yes.
And I did something for Boris I've never done for any other guest to the Institute, and that is I went to his hotel to pick him up in a car, not because I was so in awe of him, but because I wasn't 100% sure that he was going to get to the venue. And of course, when I got there, it wasn't quite clear where he was, and he wasn't at the rendezvous and so on. And yet, when we finally bundled him into the car and got him to the venue, he had these sort of 60 members of the Great and the Good in the palm of his hand and was absolutely captivating. And similarly, in 2017, he basically made the case for Brexit. And by the way, I think Brexit is a grave unforced error on the part of the Brits. I regret it. I wish they hadn't done it. I hope they change their mind. I fear they won't. But it was the most persuasive, humorous, amusing case for Brexit that one could possibly make. Mm. So he is a politician. I think I profoundly disagree with him on Brexit, but he is a politician of enormous gifts as well as enormous deficits.
It's sort of a perfect karma that it's come back to him with this very tight deadline to deliver Brexit, because without him, it's unlikely that it would have happened in the first place. Do you think he'll achieve it by the 31st of October? Do you think he'll...
I don't know if it's karma. I think he wants... I mean, obviously, he wanted the job. He's hugged it. He's taken it. And so now he has the opportunity either to deliver it or to flub it. I think you're right that absent Boris Johnson, Britain would not be Brexiting, because the vote was pretty close and he was by far the most dynamic and interesting and attractive character on the Brexit side. I mean, other than him, it was sort of Nigel Farage and Mr. Gove, and I don't think they would get a majority. So will he deliver it? Well, you know, who knows? It's such a complicated sort of palaver. I wrote an article last week about this, and I said I don't know whether he will succeed or not, but I'm not 100% convinced he will fail. And I have noticed that everybody seems to be absolutely certain that he will fail, and I'm not certain of that, because he has one advantage that in those negotiations that Mrs. May didn't have.
He
believes in it. Mm. He's a believer. He was a Brexiteer. And so maybe if the EU decides to make some concessions, and they may, maybe he can come up with a package that he can sell to the ultras, and maybe they will buy it from him in a way that they wouldn't buy it from Mrs. May. Maybe. But maybe he won't. Maybe he will fail as well.
He's genuinely fond, I think, of Australia. He a lovely phrase in your speech where he said he's interested in the Australian cast of mind. And I'd love a speech just on what he thinks that is. But obviously, you know, it's a week in, he's an unusual character. But if Brexit is successful under his leadership, what might that mean for Australia?
Well, first of all, he does have these very interesting links to Australia. He did a term, I think, at Timbertop, like Prince Charles. Maybe he's qualified to be Australia's head of state by that measure. he interestingly, improbably, I think he mentioned in that lecture that he was a visiting professor at Monash, which seems quite unlikely. He mentioned that after he spent this gap year at Timbertop, he went home to London and he just spoke in Australian vernacular for a year, and he insisted on wearing his stubbies around London for a year. So he was, which is a sight, you know, it's hard to unsee that image, isn't it? But so I think he's very pro-Australian, and there's lots of links between, and of course this coincidence of having conservative leaders in Australia and Britain at the same time, and you know, people who move between them, like Linton Crosby and others, so is interesting. I don't think, having said that has many implications. And the reason is that we have a great relationship, but there's a great relationship between Britain and Australia. It can't get much greater. We could do a bit more trade, but probably not much more trade. Mm. An Australian free trade agreement is not going to save Britain. The Commonwealth is not going to replace for Britain what it had in the European Union. The fact is that the likely effect in the short to medium term of Brexit is that Britain continues to be inwardly focused, and it continues to move away from the mainly benign role that it's had for the last few decades, which is of being an outward-looking liberal force in the world, that a rare Western country that is prepared to put its troops on the line, that is prepared to use force in what it regards as liberal ends. Sometimes it gets it wrong, as in Iraq, in the case of Iraq, sometimes it gets it right. But I think at a time when the West has lost its mojo, when authoritarian states are up on their hind legs, we need Britain to be playing a positive role in the world. And I fear that whatever happens with Brexit, it will be consumed by all of this stuff for the next few years. Because, of course, as you know, the getting out of, you know, the no-deal Brexit or whatever, that's just the beginning of the process. Then they have to negotiate the actual agreement that will govern the relationship between Britain and the European Union in the future. So, sorry, it's a long answer, but to answer your question, for those sort of Anglosphereists who say there's this great sunny uplands where Britain and Australia can do all these sorts of things, no, because we already have a great relationship, and the great loss here is going to be the weakening of ties between Britain and Europe and the weakening of the ties that bind the West.
I can't imagine what it's like to be, well, you actually, I was going to say a foreign policy expert at the moment, obviously there's always so much going on, but right now it feels, I mean, does it feel to you, the world as a whole, more uncertain than...
Definitely.
Definitely. Does it feel more dangerous?
Yes. Yes, it does. It does. But not in the sense because, you know, I think as I mentioned before, because President Trump is so sort of allergic to the use of force, it's not... I don't lie awake thinking that, you know, that he's going to press the button, the nuclear button, he's going to, you know, and take us all into a big conflict. It can happen, but it's not that. It's more the kind of world that we've become accustomed to, which was imperfect and fragile and so on, but nevertheless was so much better than almost any other international order that's ever existed in the history of humanity. It is turning out to be quite fragile, and when you have a president of the United States who doesn't believe in the order, who thinks the order is a sham, and when you have when you have countries that are growing in strength that are prepared to test it, and when you have a lot of Western countries who are just very domestically focused, it does feel like the liberal international order is becoming less liberal and less international and less orderly. So not dangerous in the sense that I think we're going to stumble into a nuclear war, but in the sense that I think the world we've enjoyed and I've grown up in is fraying, and you know it's not quite finished, but you start to fear that it is finished.
The nation that's going to probably have more to say about this than any other, of course, is China. Before we bring it to a sort of Australia-China relations, I probably need to hear your view on US-China relations and where Australia then guides its foreign policy to fit between what is at the moment a trade war and a quite hostile relationship.
The US-China relationship has been for some years the most important bilateral relationship in the world, and it's increasingly troubled. You go to both Washington and Beijing and you mainly encounter hawks on both sides, and in Washington it's pretty much across the board a hardening of policy on China, from business, from the military, from, you know, in think tanks, in government, and similarly, I think to a large degree, you see that in Beijing too. Interestingly, Mr. Trump is... I really see Mr. Trump as a bit of a dove on China rather than a hawk. In fact, I think the tough approach he's taken on trade towards China, to me, is not really about China, it's about trade. Because trade is Donald Trump's real red line. That's the thing that he's never seen a trade agreement that he agrees with. He thinks America is being ripped off now by the Chinese, but before that it was the Japanese and the Europeans and others. And Mr. Trump actually sort of oscillates in his relationship with China and with Xi Jinping. And quite often, you know, there was the beginnings of a real bromance with Xi Jinping, because like Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping is a guy who gets the job done, and he's a guy you can make a deal with. So Mr. Trump, in a way, is a bit of a dove, I think. But I think if you come back, if you take the focus out for Mr. Trump, which is what I was trying to do earlier as well, and you look at the longer line of things, it is a very complicated, worrying relationship, because, you know, it's a cliche, but for thousands of years we've known that the relationships between established and rising powers are very difficult and very complicated, and how that transition is managed is very hard thing to land.
And so what of Australia's approach then, do you think? What's important about it? What are we doing well? And where do you think we'll land?
Well, I think actually the settling point, the Morrison government's settling point on China is not clear. Under Mr. Turnbull, there was a hardening of policy. Under Mr. Morrison, I don't think we yet know where the government will land, because on the one hand, Mr. Morrison, as you point out, is pretty pro-Trump, talks a lot about values, talks a lot about the alliance, is going to Washington for the state dinner and so on. On the other hand, his speeches on China are actually pretty balanced and careful. I attended one of them at Bloomberg about a month ago, and he's very careful on that kind of thing. And of course, as a former treasurer and a prime minister who's determined that the budget will stay in surplus and that he will win the next election, he knows that one thing that would surely put the budget into surplus and would complicate his plans for re-election would be a major blue between Australia and China. So I don't know the answer to where we will settle on China. What I will say is that, to me, the guiding light in, you know, you asked me what's important in the relationship with China, how should we think about it? To me, we have to be smart enough to think, where do our interests overlap with China? And when they overlap, we need to think, how can we be ambitious in our relationship with China? How can we deepen our relationship with China? Sometimes we will say yes to China when America is saying no to China. But then at the same time, when our interests diverge, when they diverge, when they're different, how do we have the intestinal fortitude to say no to China? Because it's very hard to say no to China. They are quick to impose costs on you. They're very good at using their stakeholders in your country to influence your decision making. And it's a very difficult balance to strike, to cooperate where our interests converge, but to be clear and consistent and strong when our interests diverge.
There's some, you know, interesting things with Scott Morrison and our closer regional neighbours, that, you know, this has been easy to observe, I think, that he seems to be very focused on our closer, smaller neighbours. Mm-hmm. Is that a formed track for him, do you think, to strengthen those relationships in the neighbourhood as partly a way of looking to deal with China in the future?
You're talking about the South Pacific?
Yes.
Mainly, yeah. Well, the so-called Pacific step-up started under Mr. Turnbull, so the groove was already there. But I think, in a way, it fits Mr. Morrison very well, because it seems like he's had a lot of personal experience, actually, with the Pacific before he came to office. He does have a genuine affection for the Pacific in the way that not all Australian politicians do. Actually, Julie Bishop did as well. She had a real interest in Papua New Guinea. And a lot of Australian foreign ministers and prime ministers are not interested in the Pacific, and they at all. So he's interested in that.
Is there a reason why that you know of?
I don't know for certain. I mean, people Yeah, I don't know. Okay. I think it's something to do with his life experiences. I think he's been to the Pacific quite a bit with his family. In any case, I think it's great. I think it's terrific to have a Prime Minister who's interested in the Pacific. We hosted Mr. Marape, the new PNG Prime Minister, last week in Australia, and he visited the Lowy Institute and spoke to us. So I think that's all good. How much is it related to China? I don't think it's coincidental. China is expanding its influence all over the world, including in the Pacific. The Pacific's not a particular focus for it, but it's so big that you are feeling its influence everywhere. And you only have to go to Papua New Guinea to drive along a street in Papua New Guinea, and everywhere you will see signs, and you'll see this construction project is being delivered by this Chinese company or whatever. It's a real presence. So I don't think it's all about China. I think Australian policy on the Pacific is a bit of a pendulum. We sort of go through periods of interest, and then we go through periods of exasperation where we focus on the rest of the world. And I think it's about time we came back to the Pacific anyway. But the fact that this area where we have been the metropolitan power for so long, forever really, that the fact that there is a new, that there's potentially another another challenger in the region is not unrelated to that.
Mm. Tell us what was interesting in your meeting last week with the new PNG leader. From his perspective in Papua New Guinea, looking at the world, looking at Australia, did anything he said particularly interest you or move you?
Well, one thing that I'm always struck with Pacific Island peoples and Papua New Guineans in particular is the warmth, the huge warmth that you get. I mean, he actually came to the Institute with a delegation of about half a dozen ministers and half a dozen governors. And at the end of the event, he introduced all of them, and they all sort of got up. It was very churchy. It was very sort of, and they were clapping each other, and it was wonderful. So the warmth was my biggest memory. I think he said a few interesting things. He said that he was self-critical about where Papua New Guinea is. He said we have not succeeded as a country. So often we've had the opportunities and we haven't taken them.
How refreshing.
Yeah,
a politician actually speaking honestly.
Well, it's easier to do it when you're just in office and you're blaming your predecessors, yeah, I will say.
True. And most of our prime ministers have an opportunity to do that for their old term. They're so quick.
But yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we never hear it.
Yeah, I mean, so he talked a good book about becoming less dependent on Australia, about actually helping Australia to solve other problems around the world rather than being dependent on Australian assistance, on getting its own house in order and dealing with corruption, on all those sorts of questions. It's a hard road to hoe. So I hope when he comes back next time to the Lowy Institute, he has positive things that he can report.
Mm. Well, it's a wonderful thing for Lowy to have hosted him. We've got a few minutes for a couple of questions. If you would like to ask a question, please put your hand up.
Yeah, I'd just like to challenge this statement about the US being a resilient liberal democracy. I guess compared with all the other liberal democracies I'm aware of, the outcomes are pretty poor in many areas, like the minimum wage, labour rights, gerrymandering, politicised Supreme Court, health costs, things like that. So I'm just sort of challenging the liberal bit of the liberal democracy.
Well, fair enough. I guess that's about whether you're making a point about whether the United States is a successful society and whether it's a successful democracy and a successful liberal democracy. And I would say the United States has it has areas where it's hugely successful, and it's more successful than other countries, and it has areas where it's very unsuccessful, and poverty and many of the things, the lack of universal healthcare and so on. I would agree with you that those are not measures of a successful country, and equally the gun deaths, for example, is one area where where their democracy is flawed and their society is less successful than I would like to see it be. But my point was not about its success, but its resilience. And the point I was trying to make was that that a lot of the institutions, with some notable exceptions, as I mentioned, like the GOP, have stood up. The press, no one could say that the free press has buckled under President Trump. No one could say that the Congress doesn't continue to provide checks and balances, no one could say, as I alluded earlier to the deep state, which is a bit cheeky, but nevertheless, President Trump has not been able to implement his agenda as fully or as completely as he would like to do, because brave career civil servants have said no, and they've said, well, we disagree with that, and we're going to work around the system, and so it's in that sense. So that's what I meant, really. I wasn't saying they're the most successful country in the world, but I was saying that most of their liberal institutions have proved resilient under the huge pressure of having a president of the United States who has, in many respects, illiberal instincts.
Hello, my name is Jim Clark. Thank you for a valuable and interesting discussion.
Thank you.
My question is two-pronged. First of all, how significant is or should be Timor-Leste with Australia? And secondly, could you comment, please, on Australia's latest refusal to pay Timor-Leste the royalties, which seemingly are rightfully that country's?
Well, I'm not up to speed on the latest issue of the royalty, so I'm not going to comment on that. I will say that it may surprise you to know that I have a long history with East Timor, or Timor-Leste. I wrote my honours thesis on Timor-Leste, and when in 2000 I spent some time in the UN mission in Timor-Leste. And I have enormous affection for Timor-Leste as a country, and the people are beautiful, the country is beautiful. And I went back to Timor-Leste for the first time a couple of years ago, and I was really horrified, first of all, by the anti-Australian feelings abroad in that country, and secondly, by the lack of progress that has been made across every possible development indicator in the years since, let's be honest, Australia helped them to achieve independence. I thought that the historic approach we took on in relation to the oil and gas was wrong-headed, and I thought we prosecuted it in too vigorous a way, and we should have made the concession that we ultimately did. We should have made that earlier to Timor-Leste, because it means a lot more to them than it does to us. But I don't buy, as someone with a long history with Timor-Leste, I don't buy the dominant or the narrative that our relationship with Timor-Leste is one betrayal after another. I have to say to you that that the quality of governance that Timorese leaders have given to Timor-Leste since independence has not been high. The level of corruption is very great. And we have committed all sorts of sins in relation to Timor-Leste, but I also feel that to some extent we are used as an excuse as to why the development, the human rights and the development of the Timorese people haven't progressed more since independence. So to answer the first part of your question, how important is Timor-Leste to us? It's a country with which we have deep historical links. It's a country that many of us, including me, have personal links to. It's a small country in our immediate region. It's a country we should do right by. It's a country we want to stay close to. But let's not kid ourselves that all the fault lies on our side, because I don't think that's true.
The science shows that we are facing an existential threat globally with climate damage, and yet the theatre of politics globally is distracting attention away from it completely. It hasn't even been mentioned tonight. So my question is very simple. What about climate change? What about climate damage? What about climate action?
Particularly interesting for Australia and the relationship in the Pacific, where...
Definitely. Great question. Great question. I should have mentioned that when Sally asked me how dangerous is the world, because not only is the liberal order fraying, but the planet is heating up. And if we can't solve, other sorts of quibbles between states, how do we solve this very wicked problem of climate change? And yes, we feel it very much. In fact, I was at a thing at the Shangri-La Dialogue recently where Australian representatives were talking up the step up in the Pacific, and the Pacific Islanders were saying, yes, but our number one enemy is climate change. I think Australia should be much more full-throated. I think we should have a different set of policies in how we treat climate. But I'm not going to surrender to pessimism on this, because I think, and this is probably a very Pollyanna-ish view, it feels to me like the climate wars in Australia are receding a bit. Mr. Abbott has been voted out of Parliament in part because of his position on climate. When I read the papers now, I don't detect the same number of op-eds of people denying the science. Now the argument has moved to the costs that should be borne, but it feels to me like the debate is shifting. Lowy Institute polling shows that this year in the Lowy Institute poll, Australians rank climate as the most critical threat to our interests in the next 10 years. So public opinion is on the side of the angels. I think that because climate change is real, I think the political imperative for governments, including conservative governments, to do more on climate will increase. It will not decrease. It's not going to go away. Call me very optimistic, but I think
I'm going to call you very optimistic. I mean, Scott Morrison's the guy that took coal into the Parliament.
Yeah, you're right. He has that history as a coal fancier, but. I think Mr. Morrison could do a Nixon to China thing here. And I think if he wants to be a long-term prime minister, because climate change is real, I think to occupy the centre ground, to align with where the public sits on this issue, as revealed in Lowy Institute and other polling, I think over time he will move, I hope he moves to a different policy position when it comes to climate.
See, I knew coming here tonight that you usually do calm me down, Michael, about the world, right? Like I always feel better after having a conversation with you. I'm not less alarmed about the world. I'm really not. I can't pretend that I am. And I feel like you're. Answer to my question about whether it had ever felt more dangerous really worries me, because I think you are somebody who's both level-headed and an optimistic human being, and I'm not sure I'm either. So I'm just going to have to take the discomfort of that. It's, you know, you have said it, Bob Carr said it, about the feeling that the world has never been... felt more dangerous. Stephen Smith as well was a guest here last year and pretty much said the same thing. A lot of very well qualified people on the state of human relations and nation-state relations to have us quite alarmed. Having said that, isn't it great to know there are people like you to understand it, to be influential in it, and to be able to share it with audiences like ours in ways that we can all understand. It's a gift and we're really, really grateful. The Lowy Institute website, if you don't visit it, you know, have a look at it. It's just amazing, the information they have on their website, their annual poll, the research they do. Also, these wonderful little books that they're publishing now, It's just got so much fantastic analysis and research, and I think it's one of Australia's really most wonderful institutions, along, of course, with the Wheeler Centre. I want to thank you all for coming tonight and being such a wonderful, animated, engaged audience. And Michael, thank you to you. Thank you so much. Let's not leave it another 3.5 years just in case, you know, we don't have a room to sit in, right? Michael Fullilove.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Michael Fullilove in conversation with Sally Warhaft for the Wheeler Centre's Fifth Estate podcast. This episode was recorded live in Melbourne on Tuesday, the 30th of July, 2019. Coming up over the next month, we have a handful of special editions of the Fifth Estate, with Sally appearing at Bendigo and Melbourne Writers' Festivals to talk about women's work, the future of Indonesia, and anti-Semitism. Visit wheelercentre.com to find out more. Until next time, take care.